hearing you all. I'm K2 Kilowatt, K2 Romeo India Whiskey.
My name is Dick,
and along with Mel, K2 Kilowatt Echo Yankee, we try to run a thing called the Technical Men, which gathers amateur radio operators together, and we give each other information. That's the main thing that ham radio is good for, communication. Communication among people, particularly technically oriented people. Questions on the TechNet usually involve the details of ham radio, things like antennas and favorite transmitters and receivers and feed lines and propagation, and the 26 different kinds of ham radio. So if you're not happy with the one you're using, try one of the other 25 kinds. A person signs into the TechNet by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. Some of the more frequent sign-ins are Rich N2EO, Joe W2RYY, Paul WS2N, our space expert, Eric KE2EJ, our person who has a lot of experience in broadcast engineering. In fact, many of us in ham radio wish we were in broadcast. Many of us wish we were in some other technical field. So an awful lot of science and technology gets discussed on the TechNet. So questions that are appropriate for the TechNet are essentially any question that would be of interest to a curious radio amateur. So some of the questions range pretty far and wide. At first they may sound like they're not ham radio oriented. And we have quite a bit of latitude along those lines. So do we have any check-ins tonight? Please give me your call letters and name at this time. K2RIW.
N2EO, Rich and yes.
Rich recognized. Anyone else?
This is Gila Charlie 2, Tango Delta Lima, John in Limbrook. Good evening to the net.
And will you have a question, John? Is that a yes?
Yes, I do.
Fantastic. Okay, you're number two on the list. Rich and John so far. Anyone else like to check in? Please give me a call letters and name at this time.
Okay, good evening all, K2KEY.
And there's our mystery guest, Mel. Very good. Anyone else? I hope we have Paul tonight. I hope we have Eric. Anyone else to check in? Give me your call letters and name right now.
KC2MDP. Steve, no questions.
Steve recognized with a no. Okay. If we have a late night tonight, there's a subject I want to discuss with you guys with reference to radio frequency biohazard, and cell phones in particular. A recent article has just come to my attention, which is just a real mind blower. Anyone else to check in? Give me your call letters and name at this time.
KC2QFJ, Stephen, yes?
Stephen, okay, you're number three on the list. Let's start off with Rich, N2EO. What's going on in Whitestone? And is Jingles as happy as she was when she was a little kitten? You got it, Rich.
Okay, good evening, Dick. And Jingles, you just insulted Jingles. He's a he, and he's outside right now. Good evening, N2EO. Dick, I had a question. You had mentioned some time ago, a number of times, dealing with astronomy, or radio astronomy in particular, the big wow. So I did a search on Google today for the big wow, and I was reading about it. There's a telescope known as the Big Ear. I believe it's in Cleveland or Cincinnati, I read. And they said that this signal came in. It was off the charts, it was so loud, and some scientists believe that it came, it's man-made, or whatever-made. Others believe that it was a reflection or falling debris from a satellite that just got into the aperture of the antenna. What is your take on this, Dick? I believe the Big Ear has something to do with John Krause, W-H-J-K, but maybe I'm wrong. I may be confused on that. And what is your take on this? And where was that thing pointed when it got that big wow, I believe, in 1977? Was it pointed on our own galaxy, in some other galaxy? And maybe you can elaborate on it. It's just something that interests me. Over to next.
Very fine, Rich. And a good question. The Big Ear Radio Telescope, constructed by John Krause, WHJK, is the second or third major radio telescope that John constructed, and it was his largest one. The previous one, which you can see in some of the VHF manuals, was a very large array of helical antennas. Big Ear was an extremely large parabolic surface on the ground, which looks a little bit like the screen of a drive-in movie theater, but it was much, much bigger and wider. And in front of it was a reflecting surface, a flat surface parallel to the ground. And then on the other end of this reflecting surface was this tiltable, large, rectangular, flat surface. So by tilting that surface, you could select what elevation angle the telescope looked at. The telescope generally was aimed dead south. You selected what angle of elevation it looked at, and it's a so-called meridian transit type telescope. In other words, as the Earth rotates roughly 15 degrees per hour, it sweeps across that particular swath of sky that you have chosen by choosing the tilt angle of that rectangular reflector, which is the elevation angle setting device. The telescope was built in Miamisburg, Ohio, on quite a few acres of land. I visited that telescope in 1974, 73, not quite sure of the exact year I visited it, and had an interesting tour, probably by the guy who is mentioned in the article that I mentioned last week, this book that I'm reading on 13 things that don't make sense. Anyhow, the man who ran the telescope gave me the Cook's tour. He was happy to see me because I represented Airborne Instruments Laboratory, and they were the constructor of the low-noise parametric amplifier that was used on the front end of this telescope that operated on essentially 1420 megahertz. Let me drop. 1420 megahertz was chosen because it's a nice high microwave frequency where you can develop some good gain of antennas. It's in the so-called watering hole between roughly 1 and 10 gigahertz where the Earth's atmosphere is reasonably transparent. 1420 megacycles, the so-called hydrogen line, 23 centimeters, was it 21 centimeters, is the frequency at which neutral hydrogen floating around the universe, the most abundant element in the universe, neutral hydrogen resonates at 1420 megacycles, 21 centimeters. So a logical thinking was that the good frequency to measure the clouds of hydrogen as well as stars and galaxies and nebula and whatever. So it's a good frequency to choose for that reason. The people who are interested in extraterrestrial intelligence also believe it's an extremely good frequency because one of the universal things, no matter what galaxy you're in, no matter what star you're near, no matter what planet you're on, no matter what end of the universe you're in, the most abundant thing you're going to see when you set up radio equipment is hydrogen in the floating around the universe. That's the main constituent of what came out of the Big Bang, hydrogen and a little bit of helium. And so that fell into making stars. The stars synthesized larger and larger molecules, and from that you gather all the raw materials by which a third-generation star, which you and I call Sun, is the result of two previous stars that did all of their element synthesizing and went into the supernova stage, blasted all their synthesized materials out into the universe, which eventually reformed into another star, and that particular star happens to be our Sun, and a lot of the material left over that had been synthesized by previous stars became the ring of material around the Sun, which eventually coalesced into approximately 9 planets. And there's a little bit of argument about whether or not Pluto's a planet. We won't go there. So, third-generation star-generating material is what you and I are using right now. That became biology, that became our planets, and the material that's on those planets. Now, because hydrogen 1420 megacycles is an extreme repeater,
time out.
because that's an extremely logical frequency, it stands to reason that when hydrogen that's present in a sun, which hydrogen was present in a star, that's present in clouds that are drifting around the universe, it has a kind of a broadband, noisy-like signal. If you, within that noisy-like signal, or a little bit off to one side, generate an extremely coherent signal, something that's generated by a very stable oscillator, it will stand out immediately as something that may be of higher intelligence as opposed to a random action of Mother Nature. So therefore, if you were going to set up a beacon to tell the universe that, hey, we've arrived, we want to join the Galactic Society, and or the Universal Society, and you want to set up a beacon and you want to start transmitting signals, here I am, come talk to me, a coherent signal on 1420 megacycles is very likely. Now, the way that telescope is set up, it has two separate horns side by side. And as the Earth rotates and you sweep through a certain swath of sky, you can immediately tell by about three or four different procedures whether or not the thing you're looking at is of terrestrial origin or extraterrestrial origin. The dish has an extremely well-known pattern to its antenna. Therefore, as you sweep across the sky by way of the Earth's rotation and you sweep across a particular source, you're going to generate a Gaussian-shaped curve that has a particular beam width, a particular shape to it, a particular number of dB down of the side lobes and whatever. You're going to trace out the antenna pattern. And because there are two horns side by side, you will trace out that pattern twice. So you get multiple kinds of correlation that what you're looking at is real. Now, that particular wow signal did not take the machine. It was the strongest thing they've ever seen. When you actually look at the alphanumeric setup that they used, and the way it's set up is that a signal of a certain strength, first of all, the background noise that you see when nothing is there, you could call it zero. A signal a little bit stronger is called one. A little stronger is called two. Call it an S meter if you like. You and I use an S meter where we have S1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Well, what Krauss set up was an S meter that 10 represented A, 11 represented B, and so on, and then he starts climbing the alphabet. And that particular signal, which was sampled...
Repeater, timeout.
The recording system recorded the information on... at the end, I think it was a hard disk, and the hard disk only had a megabyte of capability. It took a reading something like once every 15 seconds or once every 30 seconds and wrote down the amplitude of the signal as either a number or a letter. So when you look at the actual signal in its alphanumeric setup, each one of those individual numbers or letters represents the amplitude of the signal during that particular 15-second period of time. When you look at those numbers of the wow signal, you'll see it traces out a beautiful Gaussian curve that has exactly the beam width of that antenna pattern when it looks at an object that is at a distance of infinity. So that signal has all the characteristics of being real. It didn't peg the machine, it had the right shape, and it swept through at exactly the right rate. That's the good news. The bad news is the signal did not reappear in the second horn at the next period of time where the second horn sweeps through the same chunk of sky. I forget exactly how many degrees that is downrange, 15 degrees per hour. If the second horn was looking at, let's see, 3 degrees off to one side, that would be something like 20 seconds later. We can figure out the details of that. The signal did not reoccur. So that's mysterious. They figured out exactly what part of the universe the radio telescope was aimed at that time that the wow signal was received. By the way, the wow signal, let me drop and tell you how that came about. Once every day or two, a technician was supposed to go to the radio telescope, download all of the material that was on the hard disk, which represents signal strengths represented during the previous day, let's say. He printed that out on a printer, erased the disk, and started the next recording interval. He then took this pile of paper, which was the printout, brought it to the engineer that's supposed to analyze the data, dropped it off at his house, drove away. The engineer analyzing the data looked a couple of pages downrange. All of a sudden, he saw this very strong signal. He wrote in the margin, wow, with an arrow representing, wow, that is a strong signal. We've never seen anything like that before. If you happen to look at the graph upside down, WOW becomes MOM, mom. But most people will call it the WOW signal. So it had all the right characteristics. A satellite in orbit would not have traced out that curve, not even a satellite in geosynchronous orbit. It doesn't fit. It was a apparently extraterrestrial signal, or it was a signal from a very large distance in space that was not moving by comparison to Earth's rotation. That's some of what I know about that signal. And if I go get the book where I'm reading about these 13 things that don't make sense, I can give you more of the details of what hour of what day it was received and so on. So it didn't peg the machine. It went to the strongest amplitude that machine had ever seen, that particular radio telescope. The sad news is that the president of Ohio University, I guess it is, decided he needed some cash flow. A golf course that was nearby decided they needed the land that the radio telescope was on, and secretly, without telling John Krause, the president of the university, sold the land out from under him. When Krause found out about that, of course he hit the ceiling. Within a couple of months, the president of that university was gone. Well, it's almost retribution, so to speak. Various radio astronomers around the world said, hey, we will support this effort. They offered the real estate dealer who bought the land 4 times the price of the land that he paid for it. He turned them down. The satellite, the radio telescope, had to be dismantled.
Repeater, time out.
And the land is now being used for another purpose. So that particular radio telescope, one of the world's best radio telescopes for 14, 20 megacycles, is now gone. That's some of what I know about that particular signal, Rich. N2EO, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, very, very interesting. I'm wondering if there's been any research in studying these exoplanets to try and match up something that what you called in the Goldilocks zone that would have been in the aperture of that telescope.
I think the answer is no so far. Of the approximately 250, 275 exoplanets that have been discovered to date, almost all of them are Jupiter-sized planets very close to their particular star. That doesn't mean that that's all there is to detect. All that means is that's all that's easy to detect. The majority of the techniques that we've been using up till now are looking for the Doppler shift of the individual spectral lines that come out of a star due to the elements that are present in that star. In other words, the hydrogen, the helium, the oxygen, and whatever that the star is synthesizing gives you a very characteristic narrow line of either emission or absorption. And when you study those lines very, very carefully while you're looking at that particular star, you will recognize the fact that those lines very slowly wiggle back and forth, left and right, representing higher and lower frequencies, representing Doppler shift, because that star is being wobbled in its location because of the planets that are going around it. So you're looking at the gravitationally caused wobble of a planet, of a star, because of a planet that's nearby, and therefore the easiest thing for you to detect are the large planets that are very close. They create the greatest amount of wobble. So are there planets in the Goldilocks zone that are Earth size? Without a doubt. How many, what percentage, we don't know, because we're continuously increasing, we mankind, are continuously increasing the sensitivity of the measurements. A recent satellite that was issued, launched a few months ago, is now very carefully looking at a particular portion of sky. A few thousand stars are being observed simultaneously, looking for the other method of detection, which is when a planet sweeps in front of that particular star, it blocks a little bit of the star light, and you look for that extremely gentle change in intensity of that star, which follows a very characteristic curve as the planet goes into and out of occultation with that star. You can therefore determine how big is the planet, how long it takes to go in its orbit, whether or not it's got an atmosphere. And so that project is going on right now, and most likely it's going to detect a number of stars in the...
Repeater, time out.
Joe recognized, and we'll pass it over to you in a minute, Joe. And it's going to detect stars that are in the Goldilocks zone, and therefore, you could say essentially no planets, no exoplanets in the Goldilocks zone have been discovered so far, not because they're not there, but because the sensitivity of the equipment doesn't allow them to easily be detected. But that's going to change. So, your real question is, was in the direction of the WOW signal, and they've looked in that direction now multiple times and haven't seen anything, and would somebody really set up a beacon and only transmit in our direction for a couple of seconds and then not repeat? You can ask yourself all kinds of questions as to what it was, what it represents, and so on. Did it contain modulation? Unfortunately, the way the recording was being made by that radio telescope, if that signal was modulated, you would not know it because of the way they set up that particular integrator recording system. There's another thing I was going to say about that. Can't remember it right now. Let's see what Joe's got to say about this. He's probably got a question. W2LYY. I bet you'd love to be in radio astronomy, Joe. K2LYW in the TechNet.
No, actually I was going to sign in with a question before, but I can't do that because you noticed that. That's what I had to say.
Okay, we're hearing you very well, even though you said the node is down. You do or don't have a, let's see, yeah, did you, you will have a question, should we put you on the list, Joe?
No, because my battery won't hold up on this radio, it's only a 5-watt HD, so I'll have to wait till another time till the node's back on, fine working.
Yeah, but you've got the resources to charge that, switch batteries and whatever. If I talk real briefly, would you be able to ask your question, Joe?
No, I'll wait till another time. Thank you. Goodbye.
Okay. Hello, goodbye. It would be nice talking to you if we would have been able to talk to you, Joe. So, as you can see, it's a fascinating signal, Rich. Now, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence is something that the SETI Institute is pursuing. Unfortunately, it's no longer being funded by our government. It was being funded by Bonnie Oliver, the chairman of the board of Hewlett-Packard Corporation. So he set aside a certain amount of money to do an a search for extraterrestrial intelligence. And the radio telescope in Miamisburg, Ohio, its major purpose was to map the sky at 1420 megacycles. Its secondary motivation was to find out other interesting signals out there at approximately that frequency. N2EO, K2LAW, you got it, Rich.
Okay, thank you. We'll say good evening there to Joe. I guess in answer to my question, I wonder, so is anyone actively following up that portion of the sky, you know, sort of like homing in on it? Apparently, there's a lack of money here, and people think that it's not worth following up on, much like, I guess, Columbus having trouble getting funded to find a new world. Do they know, they've got an X and Y axis, they got an X axis and a Y axis, do they have a C axis? Is it possible to know how far into space the Earth that signal started at?
The answer is no. You don't have a Z axis. The X and Y axis, to a radio astronomer, is called right ascension and declination. It's the spatial equivalent or the extraterrestrial equivalent of what you and I would call latitude and longitude. So, in that particular direction, yes, there's a particular star system, which I've forgotten the name of, but we can look that up, and have other observations in that direction take place. Yes, occasionally. Are we doing a real good search in that direction? Not really. The SETI Institute is doing searches in many directions, but they are underfunded, and they're slowly establishing a very large radio telescope in California. You and I would like to see more funding go into searches like this. We'd like to believe that you don't know whether or not there's a life out there you could be talking to unless you start the search. You have to make a leap of faith that there could be, and therefore you start the search. And so our extraterrestrial searches, intelligent searches in other places in the universe has been a very spotty search. started that back in the 60s when they first assembled the 85-foot dish at National Radio Astronomy Observatory. And now that's being used by can't even think of the name of the organization that does amateur radio astronomy. Anyhow, my goodness, SARA, Society for Amateur Radio Astronomy, they are now using that dish that was set up by Frank Drake back in the 60s. And one of the very early, very low noise amplifiers that was connected to it was the one done by Sam Harris. Sam Harris took the low noise amplifier made by a parametric amplifier technique done by Microwave Associates in Burlington, Massachusetts, put it in his MGTD, I think it was, drove it down to radio to the Green Bank, West Virginia, to install it, and that became one of the first searches that was done. And Frank Drake is the man who wrote that original equation, which tries to predict the probability that you're going to find a extraterrestrial intelligence. And turns out,
repeater, timeout.
Turns out that a number of the factors that are in the Frank Drake equation are super conservative. He thought that planets going around a star would be a once in a million probability. We're now slowly discovering that every single galaxy has got a supermassive black hole in the center. Every single star, per se, seems to have planets going around it. So there's a lot of planets out there. And so that particular factor, which used to be a million to one, and now it's better than 10%, maybe it's 50% of all the stars. We've just gone up by 100,000 to one and maybe 500,000 to one in that particular element of the prediction of how easy it's going to be to find extraterrestrial intelligence. Fascinating stuff. What made you start searching for that at this time, Rich? N2EO, K2RIW?
Oh, I don't know. I got interested, Dick, because I was listening on another frequency yesterday, and I heard an individual say that NASA should be shut down, the money should be put into the economy, and why are we hurling our bodies into space? And I got to thinking things like, well, from the 60s they developed Velcro because they needed a tether for the spacewalk. The computers of today started out with the computers of Mercury and Gemini, liquid crystal displays, cell phones. The list goes on. I think the gentleman was very misinformed.
Yeah, the best guess is that we get a 5-to-1 fallout. For every dollar you spend on NASA research, eventually results in $5 worth of objects being used by the rest of society. Also, right now, you want your economy to recover. You want more people to be put to work. You certainly don't want to be laying off all the NASA employees. They're doing very good work. And an awful lot of what they develop eventually becomes a consumer product, whether it be for ordinary commercial use or military or a medical use and so on. You have to do research. If you stop doing research because you say, gee, it's not worth it, when you look at the big picture, what you're really doing is you're mortgaging your future. Your real future progress happens to be what's going on in the research laboratory. Some of what takes place today, you think it has no application. Once you discover a technique, a process, a substance, somebody will find an application for it. So you've got to do research, even though you're not sure you're going to be getting your money's worth at the time you dedicate the money to start doing the research. That's a bunch of opinions. Okay, Rich, fascinating subject. Let us know what else you find, and I'll go back to my book where it gives me more of the details, and later on, either tonight or the next time we meet, I'll tell you more about what is known about the WOW signal. The next person who signed in was John, KC2 Tango Delta Lemur, I think it is. John, what would you like to talk about tonight? K2RAW, my name is Dick.
Well, Dick, listen. I hear what you're saying about all this extraterrestrial stuff. Now, I like astronomy, and what I like even better is radio astronomy. I have very poor or limited equipment to do both. However, I heard something on the History Channel once that you could receive, like, solar signals, extra interstellar signals via a standard AM receiver. If you're driving on a desert highway or you're in a secluded place with little interference, you can receive certain interstellar signals. I don't know if that's true or not, but are there, but you know, being that I'm very limited in equipment, are there any standard receivers, FM, AM, shortwave receivers that you can buy over the counter or may have in your house right now that could receive interstellar signals?
Oh, absolutely. Even though you may think you don't have the ability to set up a facility like the Goldstone Dish, the 250-foot diameter dish in the Mojave Desert in Fort Irwin in California, you and I don't have the ability to set up that. And that 250-foot dish would make a beautiful radio telescope. The 1,000-foot dish in Arecibo, Puerto Rico is a beautiful radio telescope, and so on. Or the very large telescope that's 300 feet in diameter, fully steerable. It's the newest radio telescope at Green Bank, West Virginia, at the National Radio Astronomy Observatory. Yeah, we don't have that ability. However, scattered around the world, there are a couple of thousand people like you and I with approximately our amount of money who are doing radio astronomy. And let me give you a quick explanation on that one. When it comes to optical astronomy, we'd all like to work at Mount Palomar and use the 200-foot dish or use the Keck Observatory in on top of the mountain in Hawaii. However, the guys with backyard equipment with a photo, with a charge-coupled device, a photo multiplier type thing, connected to that telescope, it is the backyard optical telescopes that are discovering the majority of the comets and that are being discovered in space, because the major installations are too busy doing other work. They don't look for comets. So by the same token, there's a lot of good work you can do with your backyard inexpensively constructed radio telescope. One of the first places I would go is SARA, SARA, Society of Amateur Radio Astronomers. I don't know their exact website, but if you Google SARA, you will find that not only do they have a monthly journal describing what backyard radio astronomers are doing, not only do they have a website where you can buy low-noise amplifiers, feed horns for an antenna, designs for how to build an antenna, amplifiers, receivers, whatever. You can buy various components either in kit form or fully constructed. In other words, you can do radio astronomy by heat kit, if you know what I mean, John. So if you have any trouble finding it, I'll give you the address of SARA. And so that's one good place to begin. Let me drop. There's a number of very good books on the subject of how to do backyard radio astronomy. Astronomy in general, from my point of view, John, is one of the purest sciences there is in all of mankind. That's an opinion. In other words, it is a science that tries to answer crazy questions like, where did all this stuff come from? Are we alone? How did the universe come about? What are its properties? Astronomy, and there's all kinds of astronomy, radio astronomy, optical astronomy, infrared, ultraviolet, X-ray. Throughout the whole darn spectrum, you can be doing astronomy, which sort of figures out where is our planet with reference to this particular solar system, where's our solar system compared to this particular galaxy called Milky Way that you and I are part of, what are the local galaxies like of our local galactic group, what's the whole universe look like, what are its properties, are we alone in it, where did it come from, how did it get here? There's some darn interesting questions, which I call it a pure science because, in general, you can't earn a living doing that. Yes, if you're funded by an organization that's doing that research, yes, you are funded. But in general, it's hard to make a living out of what you discover with radio astronomy. But still, those questions eventually have to be answered because people who are progressive are curious. And what more curious things can you have? What more curious questions that can there be than the ones that I previously mentioned? So do look up SARA, S-A-R-A. It may be SARA.com, SARA.net, I'm not sure. But you Google the word, you'll get a lot of information. And you'll eventually find out there's quite a few books and things you can buy and plans. And one of the questions you can ask yourself is, do I want to do radio astronomy at 14 megacycles or 1400 megacycles or 14 gigahertz? All of those frequencies are doable in your backyard. And let me answer your original question after I drop. Yes, if you're in a very quiet spot where you're not listening to any man-made noise or local broadcast, the noise coming out of your radio receiver, a certain percentage of that noise is galactic radio noise. But until you have some kind of an antenna where you can point it like a flashlight and you can find out, gee, is this portion, if I point it in that direction, do I see more noise? Do I see a signal compared to some other direction? And once you start waving that flashlight around, doing what is the equivalent of a raster scan, and you start making a map of that, and you eventually make a map of the radio noise of various portions of the universe, a backyard radio telescope can definitely do things like looking at major radio telescope sources like Cygnus X and Cassiopeia A. These are known galactic sources that make an awful lot of noise. One of those happens to be the center of our universe, where the center of our galaxy, where there is a supermassive black hole, and quite a bit of radio noise is being generated there. So you have to select a frequency, a method of building an antenna, a method of steering the antenna, if you want to steer it, or you can aim it at a point in the sky right above your backyard and let the Earth rotation do the steering for you. The first radio telescope was done, the Sirius radio telescope, was a ham radio operator. Groke Reaver in Illinois set up this 30-foot diameter homebrew dish in his backyard, built out of steel plates and 2x4s, and that first radio telescope, starting in 1938 or 39, is now sitting right in front of the main entrance for the National Radio Astronomy Observatory in Green Bank, West Virginia. I have gone there on a few occasions and touched that particular radio telescope. So as you can tell, ham radio operators are very curious people who have done some of the really beginning significant research in this area. Check back with us from time to time, John. Let us know what you've discovered and what you plan to do. Since I have attended a number of meetings, by the way, if you want to get more involved, what a number of people will do, let me drop, is set aside a particular weekend in June or July, I forget which it is, in which the SARA organization gets together every year at the National Radio Astronomy Observatory in Green Bank. You go there for a 3 or 4 day conference of those people. These are amateurs, backyard astronomers like you and I, so to speak. They compare notes. They help each other. They listen to lectures. They live in the dormitories that are intended for the scientists that work at that facility. You eat their food. You live in their facilities. You see some beautiful things that you can buy. You get a chance to observe. You get a tour of their facility, which is really a fun tour to go on. Now the world's biggest, most significant, fully steerable radio telescope, that 300-foot diameter thing that was constructed there, I guess the construction ended a few years ago. I was there, I guess it was somewhere around 1998 or so. I forgot the exact year that I was last there. I saw it under construction. This is a 60-million-pound telescope, fully steerable in azimuth and elevation. Multiple acres of antenna. What a machine. Back to you, John. KC2TDL, K2LIW on the TechNet.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I'll be sure to visit the SARA website, Society of Amateur Radio Astronomers. Now, Earth is a relatively noisy place. You got all these HF, VHF, UHF signals going in and out of the atmosphere, reflecting off Earth, coming out of Earth. And, you know, what are the chances that, you know, signals from Earth are going to reach other parts of the galaxy or just the solar system or other parts of the universe and intelligent life is going to receive them? You know, these are all non-random signals.
Yeah, the strongest signals that are being emitted on Earth today are radio and television broadcast transmitters and certain kinds of radar. And so those signals have been going out into space for lots of years to a society far out there with the right kind of equipment. Those signals are definitely receivable, and therefore they will eventually know we are here. I mean, to a certain degree, we are broadcasting our existence. I've seen certain pessimistic predictions along those lines, saying that every society starts off doing radio broadcast and eventually stops doing it because they do narrowcasting. In other words, all the broadcasting takes place by way of cable TV and fiber optic and so on, and they stop transmitting signals over the air. I've seen pessimistic predictions like that. I don't believe it. Yes, the percentages are going to shift, but we're still going to be using radars. We're still going to be, these radars are surveilling are giving us an observation of the weather, finding out where aircraft are locating. There will always be over-the-air broadcast, in my opinion. Not everybody is willing to buy cable TV or direct broadcast by way of satellites, which is another kind of transmission. We're always going to be transmitting signals. So these predictions that we're going to stop doing it, and therefore there's only a small window in time in which you can find a society doing it, I don't believe that. Assuming that they develop in a similar way to the way we do. So lots of predictions have been made as we develop more and more sensitive and bigger radio telescopes, how soon will it be before we listen to somebody else's broadcast from some other planet going around some other sun? People have made predictions like that. And so how far out into space right now do we have the sensitivity to listen to? And it's a pretty significant number. To visit somebody by sending them a radio signal or listening to their radio signals is a hell of a lot easier than trying to go there. There's lots and lots of college students and high school students that are dreaming about mankind going back to the moon. I think we're going to do that. And going to Mars, I think we're not going to do that in any reasonable time in the future. Too expensive, too difficult, too dangerous.
Repeater, time out.
And there's even some doubt as to whether or not we're really going to go back to the moon. Can we afford it? And is the benefit that we get in return worth the expense that it's going to take? Don't know the answer to that one. Okay. As I said, do check back with us periodically, John, and let us know how your radio telescope project is progressing. The next person who signed in was Steve, KC2QFJ, I think it is. If I got your call, that is correct, Steve. Go right ahead. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
Good evening, Dick, everyone on the net. My problem tonight involves a small power supply. Oh, let me let it drop. I have a Heath kit. I believe it's an HWA 202 power supply. It's just a small 2 amp, 12, 13.8 volt power supply, but it's been blowing its internal fuse. I'm just trying to troubleshoot it. I got as far as separating the internal circuit, disconnecting the secondary of the power transformer from the regulator circuitry, and in that case, the fuse was not blowing. So I'm just wondering what my process should be from now as far as troubleshooting the device, which of the other components is a regular linear power supply may be most likely to cause the internal fuse to blow. It's not tripping any circuit breaker on the plug strip that it's plugged into. And there's no load on the power supply at this time.
Yeah, very fine, John. Steve, most likely the fuse is the very first thing after the on-off switch. In other words, your power cord comes through the cabinet, goes through a fuse holder, goes to an on-off switch. That in turn goes to the primary of the power transformer, assuming you've got one. And yes, you did tell me you got one. And so the fuse is the very first thing because any component that fails downrange, starting with the switch and the transformer, you want the fuse to protect your household wiring. You've now confirmed the transformer appears to be good by disconnecting it. The very next thing the transformer goes through is a rectifier network, probably a bridge rectifier. It's either a small module with four leads coming out of it, and there are four diodes inside to do full-wave bridge rectification. Or it could be an arrangement of individual diodes that are set up on a barrier strip. So the transformer feeds a rectifying set of diodes. They, in turn, feed a first filter capacitor. A 12-volt regulator probably internally rectifies voltage, puts it on that first filter capacitor, which is going to be something like a few thousand microfarads. And that few thousand microfarad capacitor probably charges up to something like 25 volts. and then the voltage regulator circuit downrange regulates 25 volts down to 13. Or maybe it goes up to 18 volts, but you know what I mean. Now, with many of the Heathkit pieces of equipment, at the time that they were built, the least expensive kind of capacitors you could buy are electrolytic capacitors, aluminum-type electrolytic capacitors. They tend to dry out, go down in capacitance, and short out. So there's a slim possibility you've got a shorted diode arrangement. I doubt it, but that's possible. And the very next thing after that is that filter capacitor. And if so, if it's what I think it is, that filter capacitor bank, it's maybe more than one capacitor in parallel series combination. Some combination of those may have failed. By putting your ohm meter across those filter capacitors in the right direction, you will be able to find out if they're a dead short. There's a certain kind of failure you get across the capacitor. Let's assume the capacitor is rated at 35 volts, and it normally runs at, let's say, 22 volts, which then gets regulated.
Repeater, timeout.
22 volts, which then gets regulated down to the 13 that comes out. There's a possible failure mechanism within the capacitor where it's not a dead short on the volt-ohm milliammeter, which only subjects it to, we'll say, 1.5 volts. But when you get beyond, let's say, 5 volts, the capacitor becomes a short circuit. So those filter capacitors and the diode rectifier network is the next most likely thing you can check on. And so you can do some ohm meter checks. You can compare it to the schematic diagram or the physical layout if you don't have a schematic diagram. But by disconnecting that filter capacitor, that's the next thing that I would be suspicious of. Is your diode network doing its job correctly? The diodes are a very replaceable item. The capacitors are a very replaceable item, and so on. So I think you see now how you can divide and conquer and go step by step downrange, adding more components back, and find out which ones don't blow the fuse. Out of curiosity, how many ampere of what kind of a fuse is it? Is it, say, for instance, a half ampere 3AG little cartridge fuse? Let's hope you got a good supply of those, Steve. KC2, QFJ, K2RIW.
Yeah, it's a 1 amp, so actually 3/4 amp, slow blow fuse, the 3AG type, class one, and I've only blown through three of them so far in testing. In fact, the filter capacitor was the first thing that I suspected, and when it was in the circuit, obviously, I can't test any voltages with power supply because the power won't stay on. But checking with the ohm meter, it did look like it was shorted out when it was in the circuit, but when I lifted desoldered the positive end off the board, and then put the ohm meter across it, it looked like a normal capacitor. In other words, initially, it looks like a short, but then the resistance goes up until it's just looks like a DC open circuit. However, I didn't think about that possibility of that under higher voltages it might fail. So what further testing could I do, or should I just try to replace the capacitor? It's, I think, 3,500 microfarads.
Believe it or not, the circuit will function, not well, but it will function without the capacitor. You could decide to leave the capacitor disconnected, but it'll connect everything else and turn it back on. By putting your voltmeter in the place where the capacitor normally is connected, your voltmeter in the DC voltage range should show you the charging voltage that's being sent to that capacitor. Yes, you're going to get a lot of hum output from the power supply without the filter capacitor there, the 3,500 microfarads. But if the diode rectifier network is doing its job, you should see some output voltage from the diode network at the point where the capacitor normally connects, and you might even see some voltage coming out of the regulator itself. So you don't damage the circuit by operating without the capacitor. Just without the capacitor, it's not doing that first job of filtering, and therefore a heavily rippled voltage would be supplied to the regulator, and the regulator will be chopping off the positive peaks, but it can't operate on the nodes in between the each rectified half sine wave, if you know what I mean. So therefore, there's going to be a lot of hum in the output. These are some of the best things I can think of. Let's see if anyone else has any suggestions on any other ways of troubleshooting the power supply that John has. If so, I mean Steve has. If so, give me a call. That is right now. K2LAW on the TechNet. I heard Rich and somebody else. So Rich first, go ahead.
K2LAW.
And Eric in that order. Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, Dick. He probably doesn't have a scope. I mean, if he had a scope, disconnecting the capacitor and putting a scope across where the capacitor was and turning the power supply on, I'm seeing if there's a blip before the fuse blows. If there is, or if there isn't, probably the bridge rectifier circuit is bad. What he could do in lieu of having a scope would be to put a voltmeter, a VTTM across there, see before the fuse blows if there's a blip, or disconnect the output of the bridge rectifier circuit. If he gets voltage off the bridge, then he knows it's after the capacitor. If he disconnects the bridge rectifier from the regulator and the capacitor and the rest of the circuit, and it still blows the fuse, there isn't much left to check. It's probably either one of the four diodes, if the discrete diodes is shorted, or if it's a bridge module, same thing. One of the diodes in the bridge is bad, and changing will probably solve the problem. Back to that.
Yeah, I agree with that. As I see it, Steve, following what Rich is saying, you have the ability to, with your own meter, if you know what you're doing, you can check those diodes of that bridge rectifier network. You've already disconnected the transformer. It's good. You could connect only the diodes and see if it blows the fuse and you get reasonable voltage output. With the capacitor off, then disconnect the regulator but put the capacitor on. Or the other way around, leave the capacitor off and put the regulator on. So each individual module that goes downrange from the transformer, you can put them in there one at a time as a kind of divide and conquer and find out whether or not you're getting proper operation up to that point. Now, a guy who's done a lot of troubleshooting of circuits like this is Eric, KE2EJ. What would you suggest, Eric? Go right ahead.
K2LAW, K2EJ. Well, first of all, 99 out of 100 times, you usually fix the power supply with an ohm meter without disconnecting anything. Your skills, you learn as you go. But I've seen plenty of bridge rectifiers short out, so. I mean, one of the easiest things you can do is take your ohm meter between ground and the output of that rectifier assembly and see if you're getting any kind of low resistance there. But if you want to pull out an old trick, get yourself a 1-amp fuse, you probably use a 50-watt light bulb. Put a 50-watt light bulb in series with the primary side of the power supply. And for as long as you have a short, that light bulb will light up, your fuse won't blow. So if you're going to be disconnecting components, put the light bulb in there, all right? Turn it on, see the light bulb lights up, fuse doesn't blow, then go right at the output of the bridge, if there's a bridge there, and disconnect the bridge from everything else, and see if the light bulb goes out. If the light bulb stays lit, you know it's the bridge that is bad. It could also be the regulator, the pass transistor, the regulator being shorted. So everything will look good up to that point. And when you finally get past a little buffer resistor that goes between the capacitor and the regulator, take your ohm meter between what's the positive point and ground, see if you got some nice low resistance there. That is assuming that it's a very simple linear power supply without a lot of stuff. But the 50-watt light bulb can be a saving grace, and, you know, as you start to disconnect stuff, it's a very good visual indicator. K2IW, K2EJ.
Yeah, that's a fantastic idea. You want to do that, Steve. By putting a 50-watt light bulb, and he chose 50-watt because a 50-watt light bulb draws half an ampere, and we're assuming that your power supply, before it's loaded, will draw less than than half an ampere, even though it's a 3/4 amp slow-blow fuse. So with a 50-watt light bulb in series with the plug, and you can find out ways of doing that, now the light bulb will light rather than blowing your fuses. So
rather than buying a whole lot of fuses, hooking up 150-watt light bulb will allow you to do a lot of troubleshooting with no damage to fuses. And when you get things working right, the light bulb will not light, and then you can bypass the light bulb circuit. But once the circuit is in the bad mode that would normally blow fuses, the light bulb will light instead. Very simple technique. A lot of amateurs in the old days have done things like that. With experience, with a digital voltmeter, a volt-ohm milliammeter, a lot of troubleshooting can be done with the circuit turned off by making ohm meter measurements in certain places. But that requires some skill, because depending on which polarity you put the ohm meter in there, a diode or a regulator transistor will draw a current and look like a short circuit because you got the leads hooked in backwards compared to the normal voltage. One of the things that's not easy to recognize is the fact that your old-fashioned triplet and Simpson-type meters have a red lead. They have a red lead and a black lead, and the red lead is the one you put the positive voltage on when you're making voltage measurements. However, in the ohm meter scale, some of those meters put out opposite polarity. Sometimes positive voltage comes out of the black lead and negative voltage comes out of the red lead when you are using your volt-ohm milliammeter in the ohm meter scale. By putting those leads across a known diode, you'll eventually figure out what polarity, or putting those leads across another voltmeter, you'll figure out what polarity is coming out of your particular volt-ohm milliammeter. But before you know that, it could create quite a bit of confusion. So, it's going to be fun to do this troubleshooting, Steve. Check back with us from time to time and let us know how it goes. KC2 QFJ, K2RYW in the TechNet.
Very good. I had forgotten about the light bulb trick. I'll definitely do that and work on it a little more. I do actually have a scope, and so I will pull, disconnect the capacitor and see if I keep it working long enough to probe around on it. So far, the bridge rectifier, the rectifier part are discrete diodes, and at least while still soldered onto the circuit board, they all appear to be good. I haven't gotten around to checking the pass transistor yet. I was just looking for that good advice that you all have given me, so thanks everyone very much, and I will come back and let you know what I find out. K2RIW, this is KC2QFJ. Thank you very much.
Okay, Steve, that can be fun. Very educational process to troubleshoot things like that. Since it's something you already own, and after you make it work well, it'll be a pleasure to use. Educational fun, what more do you want? That's what electronics is all about. I think I've gone to all of the questions of people who signed in so far. If not, speak up right now, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Net, tonight at 8 o'clock, this is the W.
Ha, that guy's talking about this particular net. He's behind the times. And Paul, WS2N, do you happen to be there tonight?
Hey, Jack.
Go right ahead, Eric.
Yeah, just a little comment about going to the moon. What Congress is about to do is actually to talk of them extending the shuttle to service the space station for a while, developing the Ares rocket, but doing it at a much slower pace.
Yeah, they don't really have any choices, I see it, Eric. The plan was to discontinue using the shuttle because the Ares is going to come along to replace it. But that would give you a couple of years of gap in which there's no easy way for the United States to maintain the International Space Station. For the most part, we always have an American astronaut, two or three, up in the International Space Station. Every few weeks or a month or so, thousands of pounds of stuff is brought up to replace the consumable materials to maintain the astronauts on the space station. If we have to depend on the Soviet Union to do that, which means you have no further backup, you rapidly run into the situation where if for some reason the Soviets can't make a couple of launches and the consumables start running low, we have to abandon the space station. After this big an investment, this many years, and this many dollars downrange, that's kind of crazy. So as I see it, we've got to maintain the shuttle. We've got to do whatever we can to make the shuttle as safe as possible from the foam that breaks off and occasionally...